Right, so Isaiah chapter 40, that's our focal point. And I want to just direct your attention especially to some words in verse 27 through to, verse 27 particularly, but through to the end of the chapter. Another question is presented to us. It's rather a different question. Because the first run of questions have been to do with who God is, God himself. They're questions which put God at the center. But verse 27 changes the focus to the way we see ourselves. And God is asking us a question with regard to who we are and where we're at on life's journey. And he says this, why do you say, O Jacob? Now, O Jacob, it's code language. It's Old Testament language for the people of God. It's quite a kind of pet name almost, because God has a very intimate relationship with his people. So it's Old Testament language being applied to the church and to God's people as a company, because we are descendants of the patriarchs, you know. Abraham was the father of, blah, 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 and then it goes on and on. And that is a continuum, isn't it? So we are there in the question. And why do you speak, O Israel? Same idea. Saying, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my just claim is passed over by my God. A common complaint, the first thing we have. A couple of weeks back, on a day like this, my wife and I were sitting by the river at Woodbridge. It's what retired people do. They go and sit by the river at Woodbridge, and then they have an ice cream at the Riverside Theatre Cafe and all that sort of stuff. But we were watching some swans on the river, gliding along on the current. I think the tide was just beginning to come in. And for a couple of minutes, one of them drifted into the shadow of a large yacht that was moored in the channel. So this very bright white bird was suddenly in shadow. Now my question is, because the swan was in the shadows, did that mean that the sun had stopped shining on the rest of the river? Or the rest of Woodbridge? Or the rest of Suffolk? It didn't, did it? Of course not. Now, from time to time, the Christian believer is a bit like a swan in the shadows. Everything seems dark and gloomy. God's presence seems to be obscured. His promises seem to be kind of irrelevant, forgotten. Things have become sort of murky and misty. In our soul. But that is only from one point of view and for a short time. And in the case of the swan, we could see that in a couple of minutes, the current would move it back into the sunshine and its situation would be changed. Now, you see what I'm getting at. There is a tendency for us as God's people to think negatively about our life's journey and our experience of God and our Christian life and so on. And this comes out in this complaint, this question or this concern that's expressed in these verses. Because the man, and it would represent us as well, is asking this question saying, my way is hidden from the Lord. And my just claim is passed over by my God. And this mindset kind of occurs again and again in the life of God's people. But the point is that far from being the real situation, it's a sort of distorted way of looking at life and the world. And it needs to be corrected because it's a sort of example of what we might call spiritual depression, isn't it? And what we find is that God is challenging that tendency, that point of view. God is on his people's case far more than they give him credit for. In fact, he's showing that their thinking is totally inconsistent with everything that's actually true. Because reality is not measured by our emotions or our feelings or our immediate circumstances. Reality is determined by who God is, his purposes, his plans, and the value that he places upon his people, who he has redeemed at infinite cost to himself. And so here in verse 27, we hear this voice of the anxious and doubting believer. My way is hidden from the Lord. My judgment is passed over by my God. I'm an exception to the rule. I'm out of favor. Woe is me. My case is hopeless. God has lost my file. He's not hearing my prayers. He's not measuring up to my expectations. He's let me down. He's got some sort of limitations upon him because he's lost my... I've forgotten. It is a sort of strange, distorted way of thinking that, which sometimes represents the way we are on the brink of spiritual depression. Now, I'm not denying that there are times when circumstances do seem to be against us. But we have to evaluate our life's experience by more than just circumstances, situations, and our subjective responses, don't we? Because we're people who live by faith. We take account of the bigger picture. We recognize that there is a bigger story than our own little part that we're particularly going through at that time. The reason for spiritual depression and this sort of negative mindset, of course, goes back, way back in time, to the beginning of history, doesn't it? Genesis chapter 3, basically. That's where it all went wrong, isn't it? At that point, the human race became alienated from God. What happened in the garden? The garden setting, of course, was originally one of intimate fellowship and communion between God, the Creator, and man, his special creation. It's not just a myth or a legend, it actually was a real situation. But then this relationship broke down, didn't it? And man became a fugitive on the run and subject to all sorts of, well, what Shakespeare termed the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. Life took a terrible downturn, didn't it? And we've been born into that kind of the fallout of all that. The confusion, the muddle, the mess of man alienated from God in a fugitive state, in a very, very conflicted existence, where basically God is the enemy until we are converted and we begin to see sense and we begin to see reality for what it actually is. But it's a terrible situation, isn't it? When human beings who are created to know God and to love God and to be loved by him and to enjoy him regard him as the biggest threat on the planet or in the universe. But that is how it is. So when you talk to your non-Christian friends, neighbors, or family, and Jesus gets mentioned, they begin to become uncomfortable, don't they? That's just an undeniable fact, isn't it? Because men love darkness rather than light. They've got guilt in their conscience. They know they're not the people they ought to be. They know they've accumulated a bad account. And the thought of some infinite person being on their case is very, very unsettling. But miraculously, God changes things for people in his grace. He breaks that cycle of negative thought and brings us to our senses and opens our eyes to see that there is mercy and grace. But we're not in heaven yet, are we? We're still in a work in progress, to use a rather naff expression, but you know what I mean. We're in the in-between time. And at times Christians can slide back into a gloomy and self-absorbed negative mindset. And it's a fact, in Bunyan Pastoral Ministry a few years now, I've spent a lot of time trying to get people out of the slough of despond. you know, they get bogged down with all the negative stuff in their lives, don't they? And they forget the bigger picture. And they don't realize that God is just as close and just as much aware of their situation when things, on from our point of view, seem difficult. And that's what the prophet here, or God, is dealing with, this situation, which we sometimes call spiritual depression. And it's not an easy thing to deal with, is it? But the great thing is that God is not prepared to accept the loss. He has committed himself to our recovery, to our restoration, to our reformation, and to ultimately conforming us to the pattern that we have in Jesus Christ. And through all the muddle and the mess, he is still at work. Redemption is it's an event, in a sense that it is something secured by Jesus at the cross once and for all, but it's also a process. It's an event, something that happened in a moment, my God. It is finished when Jesus spoke those words on the cross. In a sense, at that moment, his whole church was redeemed, wasn't it? But the process of ingathering and sanctification, to use a technical word, which you as Grace Baptist ought to understand, that is a long-going process. And it's not a smooth trajectory, is it? There are ups and downs. There are bumps in the road. There are stumbles. There are falls. There are blips. It's a messy business being a Christian, isn't it? Some days you feel you're on cloud nine. Other days you don't want to go near church, do you? We go because we don't want to let the side down, but we don't really want to be there. We feel really bad inside. It's not an easy thing, is it? The Christian life is a muddle and a mess a lot of the time. And a lot of the time we put on a pretty good show because, well, we don't want to bring others down as well, do we? But actually, we're in the doldrums, aren't we? Why do you speak, O Jacob? We feel as though God has lost our file, don't we? And it's not that great, is it? Now, the root problem, of course, is what are called distorted or fragmented theology. Every Christian should be a theologian. That sounds a bit scary, doesn't it? There's an elderly lady who comes to our church. She actually is a member at Shepherd Drive, but because she loves being where the Word of God is preached, and she's very elderly now, she must be in her 80s, she's a brilliant theologian. Now, she's never been to university, but she listens to the Word of God, and she makes the effort to understand what God is saying to us about how to live well. But every Christian should be a theologian, not in an academic sense, but in the sense that we take the Word of God seriously and we work at those parts which God has specially explained and defined for our good. And one of them is justification by faith. That our standing does not depend upon our circumstances or our feelings, but upon the finished work of Christ. And that never, never diminishes its relevance for us. So we need to learn to discipline our minds. Because if we don't, the world will very quickly turn in on itself for us. We'll become gripped by this negativity. We'll lose the joy of the Lord. We won't be any use to him. Or if we're still in the church, we'll be just going through the motions, doing it because it has to be done, but no joy, and the motivation's all muddled up and so on. We have to be captured and captivated by the wonder of grace, but we can forget it at times, and that's the problem here, isn't it? So that's the first thing then, this common complaint. Secondly, we have a piercing question. In verse 27, we find God is not simply telling us off or saying, pull yourselves together, it's time to man up. What he's offering is not offering psychotherapy or a saga holiday or something like that. It's not along those lines. He reasons with his people. He takes them into his presence and he he asks these searching questions, and there's a whole stack of these interesting questions in this chapter. So we've got to back up a little bit here. These questions are designed, you see, to override our faulty thinking. God is sort of rewiring our brains, in a sense, by asking us these questions. So let's go back to verse 12. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand? This is where people who like statistics get really excited, right? They start measuring the volume of the Pacific Ocean, all right? Stuff like that. I don't know if anybody, we've got these mathematicians who absolutely love these sorts of passages. Measured heaven with a span and calculated the dust of the earth in a measure. Weighed the mountains in scales, right? I thought I'd do a bit of something a bit geeky. Apparently, Mount Everest, if you start at base camp and then kind of measure the volume, this is incredibly approximate, obviously, because you've got to take account of the density of the rock and everything, and well, that's all a bit speculative too in places. But it's about 357 trillion pounds. Mount Everest weighs that. So if you get 3 pounds of potatoes, do that, and then start multiplying. Okay? It says that God has weighed the mountains in scales. He knows the exact weight and can quickly convert that to tons or kilos, which I'm not going to attempt to do. Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord, or as his counselor has taught him? With whom did he take counsel, and who instructed him, and taught him the path of justice? Who taught him knowledge, and showed him the way of understanding? To whom then will you liken God, or what likeness will you compare to him? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heaven like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. He brings the princes to nothing and makes the... You see, the questions are embarrassingly complex, aren't they? But these things are to form a contrast between this disorientated, self-centered, self-absorbed, negative-minded Christian and the God who loves him. To put the balance right, in a sense, you see. It's brilliant psychology. So he's reasoning with his people, isn't he? We have it again in verse 25. To whom then will you liken me, or to whom shall I be equal, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes. See who created these things, who brings out their host, the stars he's talking about here, by number, and calls them all by name. There are apparently about three... Well, in our galaxy, there are about 300 billion stars. And there are probably, well over 100 billion galaxies. Now, that's a lot of stars. Now, God's got a name for all of them. So, you know, when children are born, people get a book of names, don't they? There's a lot of unusual names now because we're much more global in the way we relate and so on. You maybe get 50 pages or 100 pages in a book. You know, there aren't 100 billion names for children either. But God names the stars. So you see, we're being kind of challenged but encouraged at the same time, aren't we? It's an amazing thing. These questions then are rolled out, exposing our narrow ways of thinking, giving us something altogether more satisfying and exalted than ourselves to focus on. I suppose that God is putting himself back at the centre, isn't he, of our world and our thoughts, which is where we need him to be. When you see something of who God is, your own problems and your own hang-ups begin to dissolve. They are no longer the central focus of your attention. We all need something to worship, but it's got to be something greater than ourselves. Now, we live in a very materialistic consumer society, don't we, where people worship their, you know, cars. The copped-up motorcycle shows on today. As we were driving up the A14, there were hundreds of motorbikes heading for Trinity Park, and it's a big thing. And they'll go around. Now, I'm not particularly knocking, you know, this thing. It's quite nice in a way, but they will go around comparing their motorbikes, which have been polished and, you know, pampered for the last 3 weeks in order to get them ready, so that they will be admired and these things, and people will be absolutely salivating over these gorgeous machines which technology has now produced, or which particularly the vintage ones have been kind of resurrected, haven't they? And it's all very fascinating, and I don't want to get weird about it and sort of say it's all idolatry or anything like that, because human beings are wired to be creative and so on. There's nothing wrong with that. But if these are the things that people are living for, they cannot satisfy them ultimately. Because man was made in the image of God, and there's nothing greater on our planet than that. So we must aspire to something greater than the creation. And that's where God says, come and discover me. And in knowing me, and he presents himself in this interesting way here, doesn't he, in terms of these questions, and in knowing me, you will find fulfillment and joy beyond anything the world can offer you. So God is putting their theology back together by putting himself at the center once again. To whom will you liken me? And there isn't anybody, is there? The God who can weigh the mountains in scales. Amazing thoughts, aren't they? Thirdly, his greatness is enjoyed by his people and applied to their whole existence. Three things stand out in order to stabilize us and to root us in a better state of mind, I suppose. Bring us back in the sunshine, to go back to the story of the swans. Firstly, God is incomparable. If you read verse 18 to 26, it's all about how wonderful God is, isn't it? He is incomparable. There's no one who can hold a candle to him. He's the supreme object of admiration and worth. To whom then will you liken God? You can't possibly represent God. So the idolatry, the practice of making idols and beautifying them by human art was completely inadequate, because God is infinitely superior to anything that we can make with our hands. To whom will you liken God? Every other agent and force in the universe, again, is dependent on him. And everything exists only because he exists. Again, this God, he never has time off. You know, he does not grow tired or weary if you come to the end of the chapter. He doesn't need a day off. He doesn't sleep. He has life in himself. Jesus said that, didn't he? As the Father has life in himself, so the Son has life in himself. And if that's not a reference to the Trinity, I don't know what is. God has life in himself. You don't have life in yourself. Your life was granted to you. And it's sustained by forces beyond your control. The atmosphere, the air, and so on. Everything exists because God exists before it. Every other life is derived from him, sustained by him, and concluded by him. But he's the Alpha and the Omega, isn't he? The beginning and the ending, the Ancient of Days. There are all these references, aren't there, to God's unique and infinite self-sufficiency. And that's where we find our rest, isn't it? Secondly, his understanding and knowledge is unlimited. TV police dramas, they're very current at the moment on the box, aren't they? They're incredibly popular. Why are they popular? Because of the contest between the criminal and the police. The same can be said for spy stories, can't they? But, you know, God is never left trying to solve mysteries. There's no case too hard for him, is there? He doesn't have to outsmart the opposition. The opposition is in his hand. When Jesus was confronted by Satan in the wilderness, who's having the last word every time? Satan is a massively powerful force. Don't underestimate him. His biggest trick is to make you think he doesn't exist. He's good at that. But Jesus always was ahead of the game, wasn't he? So God is infinitely wise. He never needs to Google anything, put it like that. In fact, every influence and every scrap of information is constantly under his direction. And thirdly, and lastly, his people are always on his mind. So this is the answer to this question, where this poor soul says, "Oh, my way is hidden from the Lord. My just claim is passed over by my God." God is saying, that's totally impossible. His people are always on his mind because of the price that he has laid out for their salvation. "He that spared not his own son, but gave him up for us all, how should he not also with him freely give us all things?" Everything we need and everything that is good for us is on his agenda, and in due time we will enter into it. Now, in order to appreciate how much we depend upon him, life has its ups and downs. You feel your need most of all, not when things are going great, but when things are going a bit badly, isn't it? You know, rather badly. That's when we cry out to him. Sanctification is a very uneven process and very unsettling at times, but, you know, God knows his people, and he knows them each one and individually. So as we close this morning, let me just leave these questions with you. I want you to think about them more and to realize that God, these are ways of welcoming you back into a warm relationship with God, because he's worthy to be trusted and admired and praised and loved and relied upon more and more every day. It's interesting, isn't it, how the chapter begins, where God again speaks of himself, doesn't he, as the shepherd who feeds his flock like a shepherd and gathers the lambs with his arm. My cousin's a sheep farmer up on the West Highlands of Scotland. And occasionally, particularly if they have a harsh winter and spring is late coming, they'll have lambs that are born early, and some of them are very, very weak. You know, they're exposed to strong wind and rain through the night. They're often born in the night. He's 78 now, and he goes out on his quad bike every morning during the lambing season at about 5 in the morning. It's not even light. He's out there looking for those lambs that have been born in the night. Sometimes he has to put them on the back of his quad bike, bring them home, and put them in front of the Rayburn to warm them up. That is how God deals with his people. So he gathers the lambs with his arm and carries them in his bosom and gently leads those that are with young, and so on. That's how we need to see God. Yes, he can weigh the mountains in scales. He knows how many billion stars there are in the universe, and he knows their names. But he knows your name too. And he knows you, where you are. And he hasn't lost your file. And he's on your case. And he's on your side.